Hello, this is international football commentator Derek Ray, and you're listening to the Ranks FC podcast.
Hello Rank Squad and welcome to Champions League Takeaway. This is Ranks FC, your favourite intercontinental football podcast. My name's Jack Collins and I'll be your host today. And joining me on a momentous night in the Champions League is the one and only Mr. Dean Jones. How you doing, mate?
Yeah, I was a little bit worried that there wouldn't be much to talk about tonight. I thought if it all goes the way of the favourites, it could be a pod that's a bit predictable, but that's definitely not what we got, was it? Well, you start to say it's not predictable. Maybe it should be predictable. Bodo Glimt to the team of the season. Maybe we should have predicted them to go and win.
Team of the season before they've even kicked off their own domestic season as well. Yes, absolutely unbelievable in terms of what they're putting together. But an incredible night. They become the first Norwegian side to make the knockout rounds proper of the Champions League. And in doing so, knock out last year's finalists Inter 5-2 on aggregate. They had the 3-1 home leg advantage going into the second leg, but they have won at San Siro. And the man at the heart of it all, the man, the truth, the legend, Jens-Petter Haga, with one goal and one assist here. Dean, when I was looking back through a couple of tweets to basically find out some old things that had been said about Jens-Petter Haga, I was listening to us from a Patreon episode in 2020, a clip that we'd made where it's just like, this guy is the truth. This guy is the real deal. And we were talking about his move to Milan. Now, obviously, that didn't age particularly well in terms of that move didn't pan out as anyone would have hoped, nor really did the Eintracht Frankfurt one, although had a little bit more success. But there's this moment, you know, him going back to Bodo Glimt felt like a kind of admission of, you know, I'm stepping away from the brightest of the lights. Tonight he returned to the home, you know, the home scene of those lights when they were brightest, when he was at AC Milan, and he has torn Inter apart. And there was a great tweet from his dad before the game, pictures of the family all in yellow saying, what a beautiful city. It's good in Rossoneri, but it's also very, very good in yellow. There's a lot of comments from Inter fans been like, you'd be going home crying, et cetera, et cetera. Well, last laugh for Jens-Petter Haga and co. But a Glimt. What a story to begin with. We'll go through the game, but what a story. And I've just tweeted about this, but it hasn't felt for a while that we've had a proper underdog in the competition who have captured the neutral's imagination. You have to go back to maybe 2022 where Unai Emery's Villarreal reached the semi-finals. But even still, that was an Emery side. We knew how capable he was as a manager. It was a very good Villarreal who were coming off the back of obviously a win of the Europa League. And I think maybe you have to go back to 2019 and that Ajax side under Erik ten Hag to genuinely find a team that captured the imagination of people and the general football sphere in the way that this Bodo Glimt side are doing.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that it's admirable that they manage to do this and in the way they do as underdogs, because in domestic football, they're obviously not used to that. So you're changing your status from one competition to the next. You know, in Norway, you'll play and you'll be expected to win pretty much every week. And then you get to the Champions League and people barely pay any attention to you initially and just expect you, well, to get battered maybe when we first heard of them, and then certainly lose or be brave losers. And they've just got so much more about them than that. And I think that there's a lot to be said. Like, this is a weird season, right? All over football's strange at the moment anyway. And we talk about whether it's the amount of games that all the top players are having to play and the lack of consistency of some of the top players being available and showing their best form. And that is true for largely the case. And for Inter Milan, you know, they've just experienced some of that here in the Champions League after doing so well last season and continuing to do well in domestic football. But Bodo Glimt, like, obviously in the last time we did a Champions League takeaway, and I was watching them and I was just like, they are such a good team. And like, we talked through it and everything else. And then you look back on this today and I'm like kind of flipping over to you know, once they're winning, I'm especially interested in the game. Because you still had that feeling that Inter would just get the job done tonight. And once they're not getting the job done, you're like, what is it that's separating them from everybody else? And it's that team thing, isn't it? It's the fact that if you're Inter Milan or if you're any of these other Real Madrid or whatever, you're just expected to have this status in the Champions League and you have these star players and you win. And it's not, this season's not really going to plan in that way in Europe. And I think we're going to see a season where it's a team work ethic that is properly celebrated. And we see this at various levels of the game when you get a side and they just work. And I mean, you could throw up all sorts of underdog stories, whether it's Leicester City or whatever else, in terms of like, they just find a collective that works. And Bodo have got that. And it's kind of unmatchable. If they manage to see off the threat of the like superstars, then they've got something that nobody else has really got. And especially as at the moment, they've had the fact that they haven't had any other domestic games in their way. And we all thought that that would be a negative, because how can you build form without playing games and you're having to play Atletico Madrid and Inter Milan and stuff? They've done it like almost at ease. Like they've won at the San Siro. They won at Atletico Madrid. Like, it's one thing winning your home games, but to win your away games as well, like, that's remarkable, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, I'm interested in a couple of things there. One being the, you know, competitiveness at the top of the Elite Stadium, right? And obviously it's a bit weird because the way that the season works with it being in summer means that the qualification for the Champions League or the rest of the continental competitions comes from almost like the year before, if you know what I mean. So we saw the season come to an end at the end of 2025. So actually Viking won the league. And in July, they were knocked out of UEFA Conference League qualifying by Istanbul Başakşehir over two legs, right? Yeah. Like, that's an Istanbul Başakşehir team who have done very little over the course of this season, right? So not a particularly brilliant team. In the last five seasons in the Elite Serie A, Bodø/Glimt have won the league three times. But there is a real competitiveness at the top there. You know, we talk about Viking there, Molde won it, and we see them in European competition relatively regularly as well. But it's not like they have things all their own way all of the time. And I think sometimes when you see a side start to make a dent on European football, and use Karabag as a counterexample, just for, you know, just for the buy, they win the league domestically so often that they are expected to have this sense of superiority. And something we talked about with like Cypriot teams winning their games in the Champions League for the first time. We talked about Paphos and how they gave a good account of themselves over the course of this competition. One of the things I'm noticing, I think, especially amongst the leagues where, you know, we are not maybe expecting as much from those teams as compared to, you know, the top five, top seven in Europe, is that when those leagues are competitive at the top of the table, when you're seeing a different winner every single year, although you're still talking from the same group of three or four clubs, I think it's really helping in terms of the developmental path to the Champions League, but also to, you know, knock that down to the Europa League and the Conference League as well, because it's not like a team is running away with the league every single year. And maybe Karabag are a bad example, because actually I think they've given a wonderful account of themselves mostly over the course of the Champions League this season. Obviously not in the game against Newcastle last week, not in that final game against Liverpool either. But generally, I think that they've done very, very well. But I do think it's interesting that whilst Bodø/Glimt have become somewhat of a household name, should we say, across the football sphere at the very least, because of the fact that in the last 5 or 6 years, we've seen those wins over Celtic and Roma and Porto and, you know, all of those teams. You now obviously add Manchester City, Atletico Madrid and Inter to that list, which is now looking like a real, you know, head of scalps to put on the wall in so many ways. Mm-hmm. But actually their growth through that period has also been fueled by the competition at the top of their own domestic league, which I think is a good thing going forward and something that feels maybe more sustainable than a team basically racing to the top of their own domestic pyramid, staying there for 15 years, not having really any competition in terms of winning the league, and then bringing that into Europe where they aren't able to maybe adapt their game plan more regularly. And look, it comes on to this game here because they did have to play differently. And I think that obviously there was a sense of sitting back a little bit last week in Birdo that you had to kind of, they had to kind of deal with what Inter had to throw at them, but nowhere near as much as holding onto a lead against a side who won are now 10 points clear at the top of Serie A. But and therefore can concentrate perhaps a little bit more on this kind of game rather than battling right at the top for three different teams. But also, you know, who are going to be willed on by that crowd, who are expecting them to turn this game around because one, they were finalists last season, and two, they will be like, it is an embarrassment for Inter to go out, one, at this stage of the competition, and two, to a team from a league that is much weaker. Now, we're seeing Serie A have a tough time of it at the moment in the Champions League, and we'll see if that continues when we record this tomorrow, and we're talking about two more teams. But I think that the fact that they were able to soak up pressure in the first half, and you're looking at the way that they, you know, defended, bodies on the line, blocks, they didn't really have an out ball for a lot of the first half. They started really hot for the first 5 minutes and then retreated into their shell. But they didn't break. They bent with it at times and they were able to fan out. But the work rate, the work ethic, and the fact that it was just hands to the pump. Nobody had any issues with getting involved in that first half. And then they hold it to halftime in the second half as Inter tried to push more. And yes, the first goal comes from a mistake. Bad from Akanji, who lets the ball go. Blomberg's shot is saved. And Jens Petter Høgård taps it into an empty net. But the second goal is beautifully worked as Inter leave players forward to try and get back in the game. And it's a beautiful pick out from Høgård, who, you know, finds his man. And it's an unbelievable finish from Evian to stick it in the back of the net and make sure that the game is pretty much done at that point. Inter get one back, sure, it was a bit of a mess in the box. And there'd been scrambles, there'd been moments. Akanji hits the post at 1-1. But at no point did it feel, you know, even at that moment where Inter score and you're thinking, wow, there's 15 minutes left here. The crowd are suddenly back up for it. Everyone's wound up and maybe it's not, okay, they can score all the goals they need to get back into this. But if Bodø/Glimt start to panic here, how does that look in 5 minutes time if Inter get another one? At no point did it feel like they were really going to throw this away. And that's incredible for a side who, one, haven't played as much football in the last couple of months as Inter have. Two, so therefore aren't as well drilled. And look, Inter have been brilliant in Serie A and just grinding out the results, doing what they need to do and taking it forward. I'm just so impressed by their ability to adapt, to soak up pressure, and then to be so clinical when it came to the other end and taking the chances that came their way.
It's the time of the year, mate. Obviously, Norway smashed the Winter Olympics and now they're smashing the Champions League. Like, they don't want winter to end. Like, that's the problem.
Milan Cortina has been a wonderful place to be Norwegian for the last
exactly.
couple of weeks.
Maybe there's just something in the air. But yeah, so that's great. Like, Norway taking over Milan and yeah, taking over this whole season, no matter what. But what I'm interested in, and I didn't see this, what was the reaction of the Inter players at the end? Like, what seemed to happen there?
I think maybe the most interesting thing was the way that the reaction and the faces of the Inter players when they went 1-0 down. At 2-0 down, it was like, oh, you know, it's almost done, right? But at 1-0 down, the kind of look of realization that this had just got so much harder. And it was a mistake from Akanji, and it was poor, you know, to dawdle on the ball in front of his own box, get robbed, and end up with the ball in the back of your own net. That's the kind of thing he will have nightmares about. It's the kind of thing that you want the ground to open up and swallow you. So, yeah, it's not a nice thing for any player to experience, and hopefully it's not something that kind of continues to haunt him. But he is going to struggle to shake that off, because at that moment, you know, one Inter goal brings them back into the contest massively. Even if that goal comes in the 80th minute, the moment that Birdo score, you see a lot of players on haunches, a lot of heads in hands. And it's like, wow, okay. There's not all that much belief. I mean, to be honest, the stadium had emptied, you know, with sort of two, once the board went up and it was 3 minutes to play.
You're done. Yeah.
And they needed four goals. I think that everyone knew that the game was up, and credit to Inter. They carried on going until the end. I think they didn't want to lose the game as much as lose the tie. Yeah. But there wasn't loads of fans around to almost go round and applaud, because a lot of them had packed up and gone home. There was just a kind of look of maybe not desolation. I've said this a few times this season. I don't think that Christian Kivu is going to be judged on what happens in Europe. Now, obviously there will be a big old investigation in terms of the Italian press and the a big kind of autopsy of what's happened here over two legs. But I think that for Kivu, it's like, right, rest back domestic control and we'll go again. Inter are in a period of regeneration. For how long have we talked about the midfield three being Calhanoglu, Barella and Mkhitaryan? And suddenly you're seeing Zielinski be a really key part of this team this year. You're seeing different players utilized in those roles to try and make sure that they can gain control. But Ella's still a key part of this. But Inter are going through a period where they're having to sort of regenerate and rethink things. And there are new leaders emerging in certain areas. I thought Fede DiMarco had another excellent game. He continues to be the leading light in this Inter team. Pio Esposito is obviously emerging as, you know, a big part of it as well. And he led the line well without, you know, being able to find that killer instinct. I don't think that there is going to be so much judgment in terms of Inter didn't win the Champions League or didn't make the Champions League final, and that's what defines their season.
Yeah,
I still think there will be an autopsy into the fact that a team leading Serie A has just been knocked out by a Norwegian side who haven't played a game outside the Champions League in 2 months. And look, rightly so. And there would be almost anywhere in the top five leagues.
Yeah. And of course, now they go on to play Man City or Sporting. They won't fear anyone. Doesn't, I mean,
They've already
beaten City. You'd think they would prefer Sporting, but I don't know. Either way, we're in for a good game there. And no, let's see. Will anyone underestimate them this time? Will they be at a loss in terms of the odds before the game starts this time, or will people give them a fairer chance?
I don't know. The only thing is that I don't genuinely believe that there's much difference in the way that they play. Right? So I don't think they approached that game against Inter, even if they've been made favourites to win that game.
They won't suddenly play a different style of football to get a result. From everything I've seen of them, they value performance so highly that it's not really the outcome. It's like the way that we do things is the right way. And if things can't be achieved that way, then we won't achieve them. It's bizarre, but that seems to be the way.
Interesting moment, actually, where there's about 3 minutes left, maybe in normal time, about the 87th minute, and the ball gets won back in the middle, and they try and curve a ball, arc a ball round for the winger who'd come on as a substitute to kind of get down the flank. And the ball goes out of play, and Knutsson is up on his feet, roaring. And his players, like, he's like, that is not an acceptable pass. That is so poor. The ball's gone out of play. I'm like, you're 2-1 up at San Siro with 3 minutes to play. But standards so high. And that's part of how they've achieved what is, you know, a remarkable campaign. And this growth from year to year, we spoke about it last week, right? With the Conference League into the Europa League, to the Europa League semifinals, to the Champions League, to the Champions League knockout stages. It's not something built overnight, and people will be hearing about Bodo Glimt for the first time in the eyes of many people who only watch Champions League football, which is totally fair enough, right? Yeah. They're not a side that you would have noticed coming through the ranks unless you pay quite a lot of attention to the Conference League and the Europa League, and maybe last year when they reached the semi-final. But this has been quietly building under Kjetil Knutsson for such a long time, and it's lovely to see the rewards of consistency and hard work paying off at the top level when the lights are brightest.
Let's see if they can win it, mate. You text me and said they will, so let's see.
Well, I mean, I don't know. Look, I'm just seeing some parallels to PSG last year, right? On the verge of going out, and then they get a big result against Dortmund, and then they win three games on the bounce to get themselves into the knockout stages. I'm just saying. It's.
Mate, I'm not laughing like you're ridiculous. I'm laughing like maybe. Maybe.
I would love them to get Sporting in the next round, because I think the Sporting's story in the league stage was a wonderful story in itself that didn't get enough credit. And this Bodo Glimt story is incredible. So for either of those two teams to make the quarterfinals, I think would be a genuinely wonderful thing. So I'm praying that we get that draw, because it would be good to see them in that stage of the competition. Right, let's park that story for a minute. And should we go over to Atletico Madrid? Because they'd drawn 3-3 against Club Brugge in a wonderful game last week that we talked about. And we've come to a point here where they went back to the Wanda Metropolitano. You're never sure at the moment which Atleti are going to turn up, Jekyll or Hyde. And when they take the lead relatively early in this game, you're thinking, oh, okay, maybe it's the good Atleti that have turned up today. Maybe it's the Atleti that scythe through Barcelona and Betis, but they concede and they get a bit wobbly. They end up winning this game 4-1. That's a big statement of intent from Atleti. What was the actual game like?
Yeah, it was pretty close, mostly. you know, Club Brugge had more of the ball. They had chances, and when they obviously Sorloth puts them in front in 23 minutes, and but quite quickly they're pegged back. 36 minutes, Ordonez has made it 1-1. A good flick on at the near post, and it's game on, because you know that's where you're sitting. And second half just kind of spirals in the end for them. As Cardoso scores just after the break, a bad thing to happen to Brugge.
Great goal.
It's a great goal from outside the box. You know, he's kind of tried his luck from 20 odd yards. Unfortunate for Club Brugge that, you know, it's not like a well-worked moment. It's just a moment of opportunism more than anything. But really, it was the next goal for me that seals it. And like, look, it's important. But like, this was Alex Sorloth's night. Like, he's scored a hat trick here in the Champions League. Like,
it's man of the moment for Atleti, you know, right now. In 2026, he has been their star man.
Yeah, I mean, look, he was literally giving a helping hand on the first goal. It was a long ball played forward. He shows his strength up against his centre-back, who probably should have done better to stop him from getting a shot away, but doesn't manage to do that. Sorloth gets a shot in. It struck kind of straight at Mignolet, straight down his throat, but on the floor. And Mignolet kind of lets the ball go over him. It was not a moment in which Mignolet covers himself in glory by any stretch of the imagination. It's a good breakthrough moment for them. But it was honestly like his second goal of the night, Atleti's third, that really is the moment for me that decides which way this tie is going, because Club Brugge was still in the game up to that point.
But before we get to that goal, because it is a good goal, and I'm talking about, did you think that Atleti were a little bit lucky with the Poubil challenge? Now, I know the ball has got away from Solis, but it's a horrible tackle. It's a proper play stupid games, win stupid prizes challenge. And I wondered, I don't think it's a penalty because the ball is gone.
But
because it's a bit of a reckless challenge, I wonder if it might have been pulled back for dangerous play as opposed to for it being denying of a goal scoring opportunity.
Initially, I wondered, and then straight away, I was like, nah. Like, it was in the moment, yes. And then as first reflection, no. So there was certainly worth a shout. It was certainly worth a shout. And they would argue that maybe they deserved one moment of luck to try and stay in this competition. But ultimately, they got some bad luck, because then Ademola Lookman turns up. And Lookman, while he certainly won't get the headlines from this because it'll be Sorloth, it's him that carves open this chance. Short passing around in and around the box, but it's his invention that allows them to open up that space and gets the ball into Sorloth in a very dangerous position. And he's so cool and calm in the way that he dispatches it past the keeper. Really good finish. And to be honest, that's it. The game's done. We're heading towards full time. And then Sorloth manages to secure his hat trick on 87 minutes. And it's game over. So Club Brugge, they'll be annoyed because they look back on this one, an aggregate score of 7-4. And that definitely wasn't the gap between these two sides over the two legs. But, you know, obviously you've got to change. You've got to become a bit more open in those later stages. You've got to try and look for something. But for Atleti, in the second time in a week, you know, they've scored four goals. They also scored four at the weekend against Espanyol. I wouldn't say that they are completely convincing right now, but at least they had some conviction about them, their performance here, to go and produce a second half performance that did dispatch of a team that they are expected to beat. And now they can kind of collect themselves, reflect on important back-to-back wins and see where it takes them.
Yeah, I mean, look, one of the criticisms of Simeone's Atleti is they've not been able to put games away in years gone by. So the fact that they've scored four twice in a week and you know, the goals that they put past Betis and Barcelona in the Copa del Rey, we talked about before, is a sign that maybe things are starting to click in the attacking third. And Ademola Lookman's introduction has played no small part in that and what they've been able to achieve. So I think that no one is going to really want Atleti. But equally, I'm still not convinced by their consistency in order to kind of name them as contenders. But sometimes those kind of things do start to play out in a competition like this. And we've seen in cup competitions this year, Atleti have mostly been pretty good. So we'll see, you know, if there is a way here that it continues to stick together and what the team looks like. Just a word on Club Brugge before we take a little break, because I do wonder if this is one of those teams that in 10 years' time, we look back and be like, wow, all those lads played together for Brugge. And they might be spread across Europe, making it the highest level. Like both fullbacks, Kyriana Saba and Joaquin Saez, I think have really, really bright futures. Joel Ordonez obviously scores the equaliser and had a bad moment last week with the own goal. But generally, I think is someone kind of destined for the top of the game. We talk about Solis and we've discussed the fact that there are clubs interested in him. He's obviously a bit older, but still an incredible talent. Diakon, who came off the bench in this one, I think is incredibly exciting. Same with Felix Lemarchal, who's lots of fun. Trezoli up top, Romeo Vermont. Not all of these players are going to make it. And obviously there is a level of being a little bit careful about Brugge, because I was absolutely convinced that Ferenc Jukla, who led the line for them for so many years, was on his way to being a top level striker, and that someone in the Big Five League was going to pay 20 odd million for him. Now he's at Celta Vigo and he's doing a pretty good job, but I thought his ceiling was maybe higher than that at that point. But I do think that, you know, Stankovic in that conversation as well, Bjorn Meyer's still quite young. There's a few players who didn't even, you know, get onto the pitch today who are exciting in their own right. Shondre Campbell's incredibly raw, but lots of fun. This is a team where I look at it and say, I'm really glad that they stick to their philosophy of giving young players such a chance. It's the way that they've built the club and built themselves to this point. And it's a nice place for them to be. But also, I think there's a lot of talent here that a lot of clubs will be keeping an eye on from who are further up the food chain.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I mean, there's definitely scouting missions going on there every week. And they won't manage to keep that crop together, but they'll keep enough of them together that they hopefully maintain the identity. And they've got a good system in place whereby they'll be able to replace them, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And it gives space for the next generation to come through as well, which is a model that they can get behind with the quality that they're able to bring in on a regular basis and the quality they're able to produce through their own academy, of course. Right, we'll take a little break there. When we come back on the other side, we're going to talk about Newcastle United, who had a commanding lead over Karabag to take back to St. James's Park. And of course, Leverkusen, who welcomed Olympiakos to Germany with a 2-0 lead from the first leg. Make sure you stick with us here on Champions League Takeaway on Ranks FC. Welcome back to Champions League Takeaway here on Ranks FC. Jack Collins and Dean Jones with you to walk through all of Tuesday's games in the knockout playoff round of the Champions League. We have the teams who are going to be making it to the round of 16, or at least the first four of the eight teams that will qualify through these playoffs. And Dean, we're going to go to St. James's Park. Newcastle United 3, Karabag 2. In all honesty, the job was done. Before this game, there was no way on God's green earth that Karabag were to come back from a 5-goal deficit ahead of the second leg. 7 changes that Eddie Howe made to this team as he looks to the future without trying to disrespect the competition. And it wasn't a plain sailing from Newcastle, but job done. And ultimately, they've won 9-3 on aggregate.
Yeah, 9-3. And I'm not here to sing their praises over it, to be honest, Jack. I mean, look, you take a 6-1 lead into this game. And, you know, fair play to everybody that turned up at the stadium for this one, because, you know, you really are going through the motions.
Bit of a party, though, no?
I mean, I don't really know what your expectations and ambitions are of an evening like this as a fan. Maybe you just want to see loads of goals. I don't know. But ultimately, like, obviously, you're seeing your team progress in the Champions League, which is very important. And I'm not going to take that side away from Newcastle. Like, they've played against one of the worst teams in the Champions League, and they've convincingly won the tie. So, fair play. I'll let them have that. But do you know what? I see this as a negative night as well for Newcastle, because there are different ways to look at this. And their main task for this game, beyond putting the tie to bed, which they did, was to act with a sense of professionalism and pride. And look, they put the game to bed. They scored 2 very early goals, which meant that there was no way back for Karabag. Tenali scored on 4 minutes. Joe Linton smashes one in on 6 minutes. And it's completely game over, right? You're 8-2 up. It's a ridiculous scoreline at that stage of a game, right? But then, at that point, your objective, as far as I'm concerned, your objective from there is to not just see how many goals you can score, like a Sunday league team who's battering the worst team in the county or whatever, right? You have a duty to completely dominate that ball, to show your superiority in a way that they can't get close to you, and you almost use it like a training exercise to, yeah, as I say, like keep possession, like literally barely let them have a touch of the ball, because they should become demotivated at this point and they should become mentally exhausted by the uphill struggle that they've got ahead of them. Score a couple of goals along the way to make sure everybody's entertained and fulfilled, but keep a clean sheet as well along the way. A 4-0 win's pretty much a perfect night. What happens instead is that Qarabağ actually show an astonishing amount of pride and passion and belief. It's a really commendable display from Qarabağ to be 8-2 down and on the night only lose 3-2. Like, I don't know how they've managed to keep their heads up and keep going. Like, when they get back into the game, if you like, so after half time, you go in, you're losing 2-0 first half, you manage to see out the half without conceding any other goals. Like, that's an achievement in itself, but you're 8-2 down. And they come out in the second half and they score this goal, which I don't think Newcastle should allow to happen. It goes straight through the center of their team, straight round the back of the, straight over the top of them. He's in behind, and he sticks it away. Like, it's a good goal, but it's as far as I'm concerned, an avoidable goal from a Newcastle perspective. There's three players a yard off the position where they're supposed to be. And I feel like they've switched off in that moment. And that's, by their standards, shouldn't be acceptable. All right. Then Newcastle managed to restore their 2-goal lead on the night with a header. Fine. Botman scores. But then, again, rather than think, right, this is it, they are not coming back into this game, let's embarrass them by like just showing what a Premier League side is. Instead of that, Dan Byrne throws himself to the floor for a slide tackle in the penalty box. Like, why he was even going to go for a slide tackle, I don't know. And while he's sliding along the floor and the Qarabağ player pulls the ball back, it hits him on the arm, so it's a penalty. Like, I thought it was poor from Dan Byrne, who didn't have a particularly good night, to be honest. I saw actually on the score apps, he got the lowest score of the night for Newcastle.
He might just be knackered. He plays every game.
Yeah, but still, he doesn't need to be doing slide tackles like that. It's bad decision-making in the moment. I think he should be above. Anyway, so they don't score the penalty, but they score the rebound. Fine. In the meantime, also, by the way, Joel Linton is one of three players subbed, right? They make a triple sub. And Joel Linton's not happy, mate. Joel Linton cannot believe that he didn't even get through 10 minutes of the second half. And he's literally looking towards Eddie Howe. And he's like, he's looking at his wrist. He's like, well, I didn't even get 10 minutes of the second half. Like, what are we doing? And he was kind of like stunned and he was annoyed. Obviously, like, this doesn't matter in the overall picture. Newcastle have gone, they've won the game. But I think as a coach, a coaching team, when you reflect on that game and you've got to be harsh because of the standards that you set, I think you're actually left a bit frustrated by poor decision-making and some poor in-game management from your top-tier players that leave you with a sense of some frustration, but also some concern going forward, because this has been an inconsistent season for Newcastle. And this was a night when those inconsistencies didn't need to be shown. And I feel that there's just a vulnerability in this team that's going to continue to exist. Like, what we know is that coming up, they've got Everton, Man United, Man City, Chelsea. And these games are going to dictate whether this team ends up being mid-table or even below, and also whether they can progress in the FA Cup, which they might well not because they're playing Man City. I just feel like sometimes you have to look a little bit deeper and just expect a little bit more of your team. And I wouldn't personally have been wholly happy if I was Eddie Howe and I was looking at the overall picture of what my team gave me against a team that were apps should have been dead and wiped away. And as I say, like, I'm going to give them all the credit in the world for like staying in that mindset. Qarabağ did brilliantly. They exceeded my expectations in that sense. But Newcastle still shouldn't allow that to happen.
So a couple of questions here, and I suppose a couple of them are more general ones, and I've got a specific one about an individual player. But obviously Eddie Howe makes seven changes ahead of this game. So there's only a couple who keep their places in the side. Trippier's one of them, Voltomada's one of them, Tonali's one of them, and Harvey Barnes. And that gives opportunities for other players to put their hands up for selection, right? In a busy period. Now, I can understand that maybe Newcastle took their foot off the gas a little bit because it is an incredibly busy period coming up. And now they're obviously going to have two more Champions League games in the next round. So that's understandable in some regards. But for those players, for the likes of someone like a William Asula, who's given the chance to lead the line here, and rightly so, as far as I'm concerned, because I don't think that Johan Visser has hit the ground running in a Newcastle shirt. There's a lot of comparisons you can draw to what happened in the summer between Alexander Isak, who obviously left the club, and Johan Visser, who came into the club. Neither have really kind of thrived in their new environments in different ways, but neither have thrived. So Asula, who does often get on the pitch and bound around and provide that kind of energy in these games, does have a kind of ability there to make something happen and maybe to put his hand up and say, okay, maybe Anthony Gordon is the one who's going to lead the line and maybe he's going to play in that number nine position ahead of Voltomada. But I think I can put myself in the frame here in contention that means that when there are opportunities, I'm the one that's getting them to be able to come on there. And you could say the same for a couple of other players. Now, I think they'll be delighted that Sven Botman is back and scored obviously a big header. Him and Chow together, I think, are Newcastle's best centre-half partnership. That's something that they'll be looking to reinvigorate in the next couple of weeks, I'm sure. Obviously missing someone like a Lewis Hall, who's been a really key part of this Newcastle side, especially when Bruno Guimaraes has been out in terms of his creativity on that left. Fine. There are key pieces missing. But I don't know if lots of players have come into that team and stuck their hand up and said, yeah, you know what? I need to be in contention for this big run of fixtures we've got coming up. And that seems to be what your description of this is saying.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Asula doesn't get many like long stretches on the pitch. He got an hour against Aston Villa recently, but this is probably
as long as he did all right, I thought, you know,
yeah,
that game.
Yeah, he did all right. Probably didn't do quite as well in this one, though. I like Asula. I honestly do. It's not going to work out for him at Newcastle. I think this will be his final season with Newcastle. At the very least, I think he'll go out on loan next year. There's obviously some transfer opportunities for him in January, but which didn't end up coming through. But I think they'll end up moving beyond him. He's only 22. Obviously had
Club Brugge.
Yeah, he had injuries earlier on in the season, didn't he? Yeah, obviously. Is he from Denmark or Norway?
He's Danish. Yeah.
Yeah, he's from Denmark and he's got a good reputation. He's come through, like people have talked him up a lot. I've known of him for a little while as he's come through. But yeah, had injury difficulties earlier in the season and this was a big opportunity for him that was probably a slight miss, to be honest. I'd say that he probably didn't quite make his mark. But Newcastle had enough quality out there in players that should have taken more of an opportunity. And as I say, like, they're not going to care particularly. Like, you know, Harvey Barnes did well enough and Tonali's done his job and all the rest of it. But I guess, were you going to ask me about Alex Murphy, I guess, was probably going to ask you about
Alex Murphy because there's quite a good pool of Irish centre-backs. He played on the left here and he's obviously someone that's quite versatile. Someone that came across, I think Newcastle were trying to do their own Seamus Coleman movement when they bought him from Galway United for 100K when he was still about 17 years old and had become the youngest player in Galway's history, I think, to play in the LOI. But you look at that and think, okay, his opportunities have been super limited. Obviously, he's played a lot in the youth teams. How did he get on in this one?
Yeah, he did totally fine, to be honest with you. It's obviously quite a nice time to come in and get your opportunity. And, you know, why Eddie Howe wasn't super experimental. He does always like to give youth an opportunity when he can. He was probably one of the biggest positives of their night, to be honest. I mean, I've obviously been quite harsh on them here in my review of their performance. But while some of the players should feel they were below their levels tonight. He's absolutely not one of them. Like, he should feel 10 feet tall tonight because he's come into that team and he's not one of those people that I'm talking about in terms of like didn't fulfill what would have been expected of them on a night like this. He was totally fine, looks totally comfortable in my eyes. And I haven't seen him before this. I'll be totally honest. I've heard he's got big potential and that he's talented. I didn't hear what he said either, but he did do an interview after the game with the CBS lot, I think it was. But by all accounts, he held himself well in that as well. So it's a big night for him in terms of the next step in his career. And I'm sure you'll be excited by that. And maybe it's something for Newcastle fans to look forward to too.
Yeah, I suppose there's obviously a danger of when you have a left back who likes flying forward and is so comfortable in possession like Lewis Hall, that you switch to a sort of left back, centre back hybrid. And they've had problems with this with Dan Burn playing at left back, right, all season long. So having someone who's not necessarily in their natural position is never going to be quite the same in terms of just their security on the ball. But yeah, one for going forward. And actually, I think being able to play just a bit like Jake O'Brien at Everton, right? Being able to play in a slightly different position and hold your own, as O'Brien has done at right back, if he can get into that left back conversation and kind of start to make his way in that role before moving into a more central role, that's probably a good thing for him going forward. Someone they can make start to maybe squeeze a few more minutes out of.
Yeah, Leo Shahar also got a debut tonight. He's 18 too. He only got a few minutes at the end, but Eddie Howe introduced him as well. So that was a nice touch.
Nice. Well, there's hope for the future yet, Newcastle fans. And they have cruised into the second round, even if tonight wasn't brilliant. Right, let's go to the final game of tonight, which was a 0-0 draw, Dean, between Bayer Leverkusen and Olympiakos.
It
was
right, should we just leave it there then? Just believe it there and move on.
Yeah, we'll just stop. It really was one that petered out. And it was a strange one in so many ways because Leverkusen came out really front-footed. Two massive opportunities for Patrick Schick to give them a lead after his brace in the first leg had given them a major advantage. A header, which you would expect him to bread and butter, really, from a Grimaldo cross early on, just glanced wide. And then he tried to lob the goalkeeper when he'd come screaming out of the goal and just completely got the connection wrong, which was a strange one. Hoffman had an opportunity early on as well. And then Leverkusen almost thought, well, we've kind of given our opening salvo. Maybe we'll sit back and see what this lot have to offer. And to be honest, in the first half, that wasn't much. Chiquinho fired one over the bar and there wasn't loads from an Olympiakos perspective. Now, their stories in the press have been that Evangelos Marinakis went and promised them a substantial financial bonus if they got through into the next round of the competition. That wasn't really on show at all from this team. I didn't think that it was a slightly more withdrawn lineup, which I thought was interesting considering that it would have been a pretty even first leg. And you're kind of examining it and thinking, wow, okay, El Kabi's on the bench. And I know that there have been, you know, some sort of fitness issues there with him going off to AFCON and coming back and, you know, basically being on the bench 2 days after he got back from AFCON because he was so desperate to get back into this team. But going with just Taremi up front, I thought he looked really isolated in the first half. And it was no Daniel Podence either to sort of find the unlock for this door. Rodinei started to put in some decent deliveries, but didn't really count for much. Olympiakos came alive a little bit at the start of the second half. Gelson Martins was the kind of starlight again for them. I really do think that people are missing a trick with him. He was, you know, a really frustrating player at times when he was at Sporting, but he had capable of moments of magic. And again, it's him that really threatens to open up this game. One, he has a great shot that's touched wide by Blažević. And then he kind of is involved in the build-up for one for Chiquinho where he can't quite connect in the middle of the box. It was almost like Olympiakos kind of ran out of steam at that point and they didn't really threaten in the latter stages. There was a couple of saves for Blažević to make in the second half, but to be honest, Leverkusen grew back into it. Grimaldo hits the frame of the goal with a sort of half volley that he smashes against the upright. And then late on, Schick should have scored again, but he just sort of fluffed his lines once more. The game was done at that point, and I think the Leverkusen were happy enough to see it out. Now, you wouldn't know that from the comments that were made afterwards. I was watching a couple of the interviews. Robert Andrich was fuming came out and was like, the only positives are that we kept a clean sheet and that we're through to the next round. He's like, we have nothing to build on. We are very lucky that our opponents didn't punish us. It was similar kind of rhetoric from Kasper Hjulmand, who was like, I'm going to have a beer to try and wash that away. And look, whilst Leverkusen are through and they have a sense of they're not going to collapse, which was obviously something that we associate with Leverkusen for so many years that has been changed a little bit by those years of success under Xabi Alonso, it still doesn't look like this team have kind of found the belief that they can get back to those heights. They'll come up against either Bayern Munich or Arsenal in the next round, and there's going to have to be a significant, significant improvement from Leverkusen if they are going to compete in these games, never mind, you know, go and try and knock out one of the competition favourites. So
yeah,
it wasn't a terrible night, I don't think, in terms of what it looked like. But I do just kind of feel that Leverkusen were way too passive after such a good opening salvo to let Olympiacos come onto them. And look, I can understand that because there was not loads of threat on the Leverkusen goal, that they were like, okay, we're kind of happy with this. But I think a goal could have changed it, and it might have looked a lot different if Olympiacos had been a little bit more front-footed and been able to, you know, basically produce a little bit more. I'm surprised by Mendilibar's just lack of real kind of go get him in this game, but he is a relatively, you know, defensive manager when all things are considered. But yeah, I just think from a Leverkusen perspective, they will need to significantly improve. From an Olympiacos perspective, they didn't really come to play tonight. And it was a bit of a damp squib in some ways.
Well done for watching it, mate, and well done for giving us a summary so that we don't have to, and we can all move on.
When you're like, which game am I going to put on the second screen? There wasn't much of a decision to be made.
Yeah, it wasn't this one. You didn't even watch it.
No, I did watch it. I did watch it. I did sit through all 90 minutes so that the rest of you didn't have to. But well yeah, done, not the game of the night by any stretch of the imagination. So we're going to take a break. We'll leave it there. And tomorrow we'll be back with four more games. For the final four games, we'll find out who completes the Champions League should round of 16 when we come back on Champions League Takeaway for tomorrow. So all that's left for me to do is say thank you very much for listening as ever. Thank you very, very much to Mr. Dean Jones.
Cheers, mate.
I've been Jack Collins. This has been your Champions League Takeaway. We hope you've enjoyed it, and we'll see you all tomorrow, Rank Squad. Take it easy. Peace.